Right now, your plans for your yard and garden this year are uncomplicated by insects and disease, but it won't stay that way forever. Today, we'll talk about preventative steps you can take before things get out of control. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse will be here. We'll talk about attracting beneficial bugs, and we'll find out what we can do to keep pests at bay. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here. We'll talk about steps we can take to keep our plants healthy. And, of course, Laura and Richard will answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and the saying goes that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Today, we're going to focus on preventing pests and diseases in our yards and gardens this year. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse is here from the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
And Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here as well. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And Laura, I was looking around at the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic's Facebook page earlier today, which I didn't realize that you had. So we've put up a link to that page on our Facebook page. And you have all kinds of really interesting suggestions for preventing problems in your yard and garden, including a whole list of, we're going to talk about plant diseases later, but a whole list of the kinds of tomatoes that are disease resistant. So there are lots of really helpful hints on there. But let's talk about insects, since that is your area of expertise. And one of the things you wanted to talk about today was actually attracting beneficial insects to your property. What would you do?
Well, one of the easiest things you can do is to actually plant a lot of native wildflowers. And we really try to encourage people to, you know, conserve natural enemies. There's lady beetles out there. There's lacewings out there. And, you know, that's why we talk a lot about, you know, limiting insecticide use, not spraying unless you have to, because we know all this great biological control, we call it, is already going on. But one thing that a lot of people don't realize is they know they're eating the pests, and that's good. But most lady beetles need pollen, especially as adults. It's a very nutritious food source, so they eat pollen. Green lacewing adults don't even eat pests. They feed on pollen and nectar. And, of course, parasitic wasps, we're very aware that all their, you know, larvae are there in the caterpillars and stuff eating them and eating the insides out of the aphids, but the adults don't eat aphids. They feed on pollen and nectar just like other wasps. So having plants available and flowering plants available throughout the season is a great way to encourage them to be in your garden.
Well, and we talk about beneficial insects, and of course, pollinators are beneficial for many reasons, because of course, a lot of our fruits and vegetables need to be pollinated. And you mentioned the wasps. Can you kind of give us an idea of some of the other insects that are considered to be beneficial? And I don't think everyone knows about what wasps can do for your garden.
We don't think of the benefits of the wasps, and even kind of the nasty wasps like the yellow jackets and things like that. They're predators. They're out there. They're taking out a lot of caterpillars, and they chew them up and feed them to their young. So wasps are fairly beneficial when they're not, you know, somewhere where they're actually going to sting you. Of course, there's the bumblebees and all the native bees, which are very not aggressive. You know, it's great to have them in your garden. I think they're wonderful to look at, and plus they're pollinating our plants.
Can you buy beneficial insects if you don't have a lot already in your garden? I mean, just planting the right plants would help, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll come, right?
Yes, you can purchase beneficial insects, and they'll come mail order. For the most part, I don't think it's necessary in most garden situations. I think there's plenty going on out there that we just don't notice. But if you do want to order insects, we always recommend ordering larvae. If you order adult lady beetles, is a really common one that you can mail order. those tend to warm up in your garden and literally fly away. So it's nice to get the immature ones because they don't have wings and can't leave.
And they might want to stay when they get a little bit older.
They have to stay.
Well, of course, now beneficial insects are great, but I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, all right, I have a lot of non-beneficial insects in my yard and garden that I really don't want there this year. At this time of year, are there some things that we can think about to try to prevent infestations?
One of the first things is, you know, if you still haven't cleaned out all the old debris from the garden, it's a good time to still do that. It does help a little bit. As you're starting transplants indoors or purchasing transplants in the next few months to put out, it's very important to, you know, inspect them so you're not, you know, purchasing ones that already have, you know, white flies or aphids or things like that. So inspecting plants to make sure they're healthy before you put them in the garden. And then really, I just think the most important thing is to constantly, you know, every day walk around the garden, look. Most of these pest problems happen slowly. And if you catch it right away, you can, you know, keep an eye on it. You know, are there too many aphids now? Is it necessary to go in, you know, with a soap-based insecticide or something like that? But really making sure healthy plants go in and watching the garden is very helpful.
I'm sure that a lot of us miss those early signs, though, just because we don't know what to look for. How do we find out what to look for?
Well, I mean, easily with the chewing insects, you look for holes in the leaves of the plant. So it's just as simple as that is, you know, the plant has, you know, holes in the leaves. Let's look and see what's feeding on it. A lot of the aphids and other pests secrete honeydew, which is like a sticky, shiny substance. And so you'll see that. And even things like spider mites, you'll start to see discolored leaves, especially the new leaves. You know, keep an eye on those. If things look a little discolored, you know, flip the leaf over and see if there's anything going on underneath.
All right. And for those of us who really don't want Japanese beetles this year, of course, we're all going to have Japanese beetles this year. But how can, or is there anything we can do right now to try to keep that to a minimum?
There's not really anything you can do right now to prevent Japanese beetles. Unfortunately, they're going to be there. Again, finding them early and hand-picking them off is a pretty effective method. But again, it takes some pretty serious dedication.
And I've talked about this 1,000 times with Donald Lewis, but he likes to mention it every time that those traps don't work.
Yes, avoid the traps. They bring in far more Japanese beetles than the traps can possibly hold. And it tends to be about, you know, 20 feet around the traps has just a flurry of the Japanese beetles. Plus, then you get a whole ton of dead animals that don't smell very pleasant in your garden.
I have seen something that you hang in apple trees that's supposed to help prevent codling moth. Is that something you've heard of, and does that work?
It's probably, we have several different traps, like codling moth traps, apple maggot traps. They don't prevent the problem. What they do is tell you when the pest insect is there and that you should consider applying insecticides. So these insect traps are more of a monitoring, helping you get those insecticides on at the right time rather than preventing a problem.
All right. And I know that you mentioned wanting to keep insecticides to a minimum with fruit trees. Sometimes people feel they can't avoid that. When is the time to start thinking about that?
You want to start, there's a lot of, you know, homeowner-based recommendations for apple trees. I mean, really, you start thinking about it as soon as, you should start thinking about it now, because as soon as it starts leafing out, we can have disease problems. And certainly as soon as we're reaching just post-bloom is when we start having to worry about insect problems. So, yeah, unfortunately, fruit trees and stuff take a lot of inputs, and really, essentially, petal drop to harvest is when you're probably going to be having to put sprays on it.
All right. Well, let's before we get to the break, let's talk a little bit about preventing plant diseases, Richard.
Okay.
And I did mention that chart that was up on the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic page, Facebook page, about tomato disease resistance. Mm-hmm. And do you find that to be helpful? Are there some tomato plants that are just significantly more disease resistant than others?
I think there are. When you buy a hybrid tomato, most of the hybrids are wilt resistant. So that's one kind of disease on tomatoes. But as far as blight resistant, most varieties are not. Now, they are working on new varieties. They are developing some that are blight resistant. So I think in the future that's going to become more and more common.
And so that might be something to think about as you're buying plants, also as you're preparing the garden this year, what do you need to be thinking about to try not to spread diseases that you may have had last year?
Well, as far as disease control, one obvious thing is sanitation. Go out in the fall of the year or very early in the spring and get rid of that dead debris, that disease debris in the garden. Then make sure that the plants that you put in the garden have the proper environment. Give them good cultural practices. You can use pesticides like fungicides, whatever, if you need to. And then sometimes you do have the option of purchasing resistant varieties, and that's always obviously very good.
And when you say very early spring, does this still count as very early spring?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, most plants are still basically not actively growing. As soon as they start to grow and it rains, then if you have that dead debris in the area, it can basically reinfect that new growth. So,
and when you remove that debris, does it go in the compost pile?
I think I probably would. If you turn it often enough and keep it moist, it should get warm enough to actually destroy the disease pathogens. If you feel you don't do that, let's say you only turn it maybe once a month, then I'd probably put it in the yard waste.
As the plants begin to grow, Laura was talking about looking for early signs of insect infestations. How about early signs of disease? Is that something we should keep an eye open for?
You'll see certain signs, certain symptoms, typically spotting of the foliage. It could be yellow spots, brown spots, black spots. You might see yellowing of the foliage. But when you start to see that, it's a little bit late in the game in that your fungicides are mainly preventative in nature, that they don't control the disease once it's firmly established. So once you start to see something and the symptoms are pretty widespread, it's probably too late.
And this is on a slightly different topic, but as I've been out and about in the last week or so, I'm starting to see nurseries having plants out and even, you know, larger stores that don't specialize in gardens putting plants out front. Is it time to start planting some things?
We can start planting certain things as far as possibly trees and shrubs and things of that nature. Not too many of your herbaceous plants yet. Way too early for things like tomatoes and peppers and things like that. Marigolds, petunias, way too early on that. There are a few cool season annuals. You could actually think about planting things like maybe pansies. They like the cool weather. Sweet alyssum, they like the cool weather. As far as vegetable crops, we have things like cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts. We can buy those and plant those fairly soon. So we are getting to the period where we can start to plant a few things.
And greens?
And greens. We can plant lettuce and spinach, possibly potatoes, radishes. So a number of things we can start plant.
So it is time to get our hands dirty.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse. And again, you can join the conversation with your questions. The number 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. And with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And as a sure sign of spring, our lines are already almost full, and we have a whole bunch of emails to answer as well. So let's start with one for you, Laura. This is from Lori. She says, yesterday there were about 20 honeybees frantically digging and rolling in piles of fresh chainsaw shavings by our wood pile. On the internet, I read that many others have seen bees do this. Some theorize that the bees might have been harvesting bits of congealed tree sap or possibly fungal spores or perhaps just cleaning themselves on. What do you say?
Well, yeah, I think my best guess is, harvesting bits of tree sap. And I wish I could remember the name, but bees, honeybees, and someone will probably let us know, coat the inside of their hives with this substance. And it's actually works very well kind of as antifungal, antibacterial agent. So early in the year, especially as trees are starting to leaf out and they kind of produce, you know, sap and stuff, they will collect that and put it in their beehives. And I don't remember the name or much more than that about it, but hopefully someone will let us know.
It must have been a cool sight to see, though.
Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, let's go to the phones. Carol is on the line in Albia. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, I've been seeing some different sweet cherries in the seed catalogs. Gurney has one called Carmine Jewel, and Young has one, Danube, red juice cherry.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about...
Yeah, for the most part, sweet cherries are not reliably hardy in most of Iowa. If I was going to purchase one, I would look at gold.
Oh, I see. Black gold, and white gold, which is
or white gold. All those three would be possibilities.
They would all be better.
Right. They come from Cornell University in New York.
Okay.
They were bred for hardiness.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that two or three of those are self-fertile. So mm-hmm. that one tree will produce a crop. So
would you suggest the black or the white?
It depends upon your color preference.
Uh-huh.
So gold, black gold, or white gold.
Okay. And also, have you ever heard of milk as a fertilizer? I understand that some people are growing prize vegetables by pouring milk around them.
I think that's most often used when they want to grow these giant, huge pumpkins.
What nutrition for plants is there in
milk? Not sure if it really helps that much. But that's typically where it's used most often is if you're trying to grow these prize-winning uh-huh. state fair-size pumpkins, sometimes they use milk. I don't know if that really helps or not, but it's a very common practice.
I see. Well, thank you for these answers.
All right, Carol, thank you so
Enjoy
much for your call.
Program.
Thanks a lot. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. Here's another email. This is from Beverly in Mystic. She says, please help us prevent the ants from taking over every one of our outdoor potted plants. She says, we came up with a system that worked like a charm. Each plant in a pot was placed in its usual plant saucer. Then both were put into a larger saucer. We poured the water into the largest saucers, and the moats were very effective. However, the water evaporates quickly in hot weather, especially in the saucers of the smallest plants. If we're away from home or forget to top it off, the ants invade the pots. We have nothing against the hardworking ants, but would prefer to repel, not to kill them. Any suggestions?
Well, yeah, the ants are hardworking. They're beneficial. It's very hard to prevent them from getting into those sort of environments. I would almost think trying to raise the pots off the ground a little bit. There's things called tanglefoot and stuff that you can put around the base, but I would raise them up, you know, even Vaseline or something, although you'd probably have to recoat semi-regularly as it gets dusty, would prevent the ants from getting in there. They're not that industrious. They can find other places to build their colonies. And it's really only a concern if you're bringing in potted plants in the fall and then you end up with the whole ant colony in your kitchen.
Right. Well, staying on the subject of ants, this is from Sarah. She says, I hired a contractor to replace water-damaged wood around my house. The contractor found carpenter's ants in the water-damaged wood. If all the water-damaged wood is replaced, will this be enough to remove the carpenter ants from my house, or do I need to treat for them? And if I do need to treat for them, what's the best method?
You've already done the best method. So carpenter ants don't eat wood, so they're not really considered a structural pest. Their mouth parts are not good enough to attack good solid wood, so they only will get into wood that's already water damaged. So we always say the best control is to replace that water damaged wood. So there should be no need for additional control.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And next up is Hayes on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Hayes.
Hello, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a south-facing steep slope in my yard that doesn't get a lot of sun because of some trees overhead, and I have a really difficult time getting anything to grow, and I don't want just bare dirt. I was wondering if one of your guests could recommend some kind of plant that might spread and cover that area.
So it is basically shade.
Yes.
Okay. I would consider creeping lily turf, which is grass-like in nature. It does spread. You can grow it in partial to heavy shade. I have a patch in my backyard. Very, very easy to grow, very low maintenance. It does spread pretty aggressively, and you can find it at some of the garden centers. So creeping lily turf. And the nice
Wonderful.
Thing,
thank you.
And the nice thing is that if it does well and you have a big, huge area and you can't buy enough plants, typically it does spread, and within a few years you can dig up plants, divide them, and transplant them.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Hayes. Next up, let's go to Rick on the line in Tipton. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I need some help with flea beetles on eggplants. I've tried various organic remedies. I've tried barriers. I've tried putting out older plants, and they just destroy them. I was very successful with them up until about 5 years ago, and every year I put them out, and I grow them from seed, and I get decimated. I haven't brought in any eggplants in 5 years.
Oh, that's too bad.
I did successfully use something called Captain Something's Bug Death or something. It was an organic, new organic powder, but it's very expensive.
Right, and often organic controls, you know, can work very well, but sometimes, you know, you might consider using one of the pyrethroid-based ones, the regular garden insecticides. Flea beetles are not terribly well known for building up resistance, but it is possible since you've been growing them and, you know, trying to treat them year after year that you could have, you know, selected a sort of resistant population to something. But in row covers would be something that I would think might help, but you say that didn't work at all?
No, they got underneath them and just wiped them out, turned them into, you know, skeletons.
You know, and do you have room to rotate far away?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I mean, I think trying to get them as far away as possible or, you know, sadly enough, just going a year without the eggplants and seeing if you can break this cycle and then start again.
All right. We'll give it a shot. One last question, unrelated. Every year, every time I grow peach trees, I get them up to about 8 inches across, and then they freeze and die.
Mm-hmm.
And they fall over during winter. They're that dead in just a year.
Right.
What variety of peach tree do you recommend that we grow here in eastern Iowa?
Well, the problem is that we're just kind of too far north for peaches. They're just not reliably hardy. If you plant a peach tree in Iowa, I think their life expectancy typically in central southern Iowa maybe around maybe 10 years at most, maybe 15 years. If I was going to plant one, I would plant the variety Reliance. Tends to be the hardiest.
All right. In that case, I'll keep trying to plant Reliance because that's what I keep freezing. I'll try. Is there any trick to keeping them alive during the winter?
Well, typically it's the extreme cold that eventually gets them. If we have a mild winter, they do fine, but if we get temperatures in the minus 20 range, those temperatures are enough to damage or destroy the tree. So that's the problem.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Rick. And let's answer another email question here. And this one is from Paul. I have a weed that is progressively taking over my east and south lawn. I've looked it up online, and it appears to look like what is called yarrow. It has a fern-like appearance. What approach should I take now to prevent further spread through the spring and summer, and how should I approach reseeding the area once the weed is gone?
Well, the first thing would be to try to get a nice, thick, healthy turf. If you do, there's fewer opportunities for any weeds to get established. So proper mowing, proper fertilization, that type of thing, where you have a really nice, healthy turf, and then that tends to crowd out the actual weeds. As far as yarrow, I'm not sure specifically, but I would think a broadleaf herbicide in the fall of the year would take care of that.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. Next up is Dave on the line in Spencer. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
I've been trying to play around with grafting heirloom tomatoes onto resistant rootstock using a top graft method and the plastic clips, hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to get along all right. I after I graft them, I leave them in the dark for about 5 days at 80 degrees. But then when I start bringing them out into the light, why, they just die. And I don't know exactly what I'm doing. Is it possible I'm keeping them too moist?
Well, the actual period right after grafting tends to be the most difficult time on grafting tomatoes. The actual grafting procedure isn't that difficult, but it's that after grafting period, maybe a week, maybe 10 days. And what you do have to do is make sure they have a high humidity, like 80, 90% relative humidity, a very warm temperature, but you don't actually want the plants to be wet. The foliage should not be wet. It should be very humid, and it should be fairly dark. So you have those three things, basically: high humidity, high temperature, and basically a fairly dark environment. And then, hopefully, if you did it well, you're going to get a certain percentage that will actually heal, and you'll have a nice plant. But it is kind of tricky, especially that first week or so after grafting.
Okay. But I tend to miss them almost every day. Do you think I'm missing them?
Yeah, I wouldn't actually miss them where you actually get the foliage wet. I would just keep the high humidity, but actually not actually miss the plants.
My understanding is 50% loss is not unusual. So
the
idea is to graft a lot more than you're planning to have.
Yeah, right now I've got 100%. But does it help to trim the foliage on the top piece a little bit too or not? Or should leave it full?
Yeah, some people do when they graft. They'll actually cut back the top part of the graft maybe by a third or one half. We're actually going to be doing this on Monday for our demonstration gardens. And so we're going to do about 200 grafts. We want about 100 plants. So we're kind of expecting maybe half to actually succeed.
All right.
Okay.
Dave, good luck.
Yep. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Sticking with the subject of tomatoes, this is a question from Corey in Des Moines. With heirloom tomatoes, when do I transfer indoor seedlings to a larger container? At what height?
Well, typically, if you're starting these in a flat, I would transplant them into a bigger cell pack or container when they're probably 2 or 3 inches tall.
Okay.
Not any bigger than that.
All right. And we'll get back to the phones. Again, the number is 866-780-9100. Suzanne is on the line from Grinnell. And Suzanne, you've had some experience with milk as a fertilizer?
Well, I just know that I'm a farmer, and I know that there has been research in grass pasture, well, I mean, multiple species pastures, of spraying raw milk at a very low rate, like 3 gallons to the acre, and that there's been tremendous increase in the bricks, so the sugar content of the grass, and increased abundance of the forbs. So it just stands to reason that if you put it on your garden, you would have a similar effect.
And
that's what I'm thinking.
Is the concept here that the bacteria in the raw milk is kind of a nitrogen fixer?
I think that that's part of it. I don't know if there's also a calcium aspect or not, but I think it's a bacteria increase.
Okay. Well,
anyhow, I just know that that's been done in research in Nebraska, I believe, by their extension services. So,
all right. Well, that's something we'll have to look into further. Thanks a lot for your call, Suzanne. So if it's milk, apparently raw milk has been studied. So maybe not taking it out of your fridge and pouring it in your garden. All right.
Just drink it in there.
Right. this might stretch your realm of expertise a little bit, Richard, but Ed is on the line in Erie, Illinois. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is taking it to another level. I got a cat problem in my garden and around my flower gardens or around my house. They're using it for a litter box, and I was wondering if there was a deterrent to keep the animals out of my dirt that's they're causing me a lot of anguish in the garden.
I would probably say fencing would be the most effective. Where you actually put a fence around the area so they can't get in, or it makes it very difficult. So that'd be my first thought. Then if that didn't work, probably speaking to the owner of the cat, if possible.
Cats can be persistent when
they want to be. Yes, they can. Yes, they can.
Heavy rock mulch.
Yeah, sometimes if you have something that might make their them uncomfortable, if you had some type of mulch, maybe a rock mulch, where the pebbles were kind of sharp, that might kind of discourage them.
So some lovely gravel in the garden might make a big difference. All right. Well, good luck with that, Ed. And we're going to take a short break here. We'll get back to our conversation in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse from the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. And you are welcome to join us with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have lines open for your questions right now. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Again, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, ISU Extension entomologist Laura Jesse and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Give us a call with your plant and insect questions today at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get an email question here. This is from Melissa in Marion. I've got a problem with both crabgrass and thin spots in my yard, which have gotten worse with last year's drought. I'd like to use crabgrass preventer and overseed the lawn this spring. Will the crabgrass preventer cause a problem with the new grass seed, or can I use both at the same time?
Well, a pre-emergent is not selective, so it would basically affect both the crabgrass seed and the turfgrass seed. So my suggestion would be to go ahead and put on your pre-emergent, your crabgrass preventer, this spring, and also fertilize, and then give your lawn good care this spring and summer. Keep it well mowed, and then if you're not happy with the thickness, with the results, go ahead and overseed in late August, early September.
All right. Here's another email from Cheryl. I have four yews in the front of my house that I planted about 5 years ago. My intention is to eventually have a neat hedge. The yews are now about 2 feet high and growing out rather than up. How do I get them to grow taller, and when and how should I trim them? What kind of fertilizer should I use? And she also says, FYI, they are in a mostly shady area.
Okay. Well, you can definitely prune them right now. Sometime in the next week or two, it'd be fine. As far as fertilization, they typically don't need that, but if you want to, you can use a all-purpose garden fertilizer like a 10-10-10, and I would do that also in the spring. And if you do some pruning on the side and not on the top, then that should encourage the upward growth.
All right, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's another email. This is from Melissa. What can you tell me about growing blueberries and grapes? I'm in northern Linn County. I bought a blueberry plant and a grape plant last year, planted each in a raised box with sphagnum peat moss, also adding the stuff they told me to shake in and mix with with the soil.
Okay.
I'm no great gardener by any means, planted my first garden last year, so I'm learning, but the grapes did not grow. The vine grew about 6 inches all summer, and the blueberry bush did nothing but tried really hard not to die. Maybe it was the drought, or did I need to do more to the soil?
Well, the drought may have been a factor on that. Obviously, the care last year was critical. If the plant was maybe neglected for a short period of time because of the heat, the dry conditions, maybe it simply didn't get established. But as far as planting blueberries, they have two basic requirements. They need a well-drained soil. They do not like wet, poorly drained sites. And they need an acid soil, which we don't have typically in Iowa. So the typical recommendation is when you plant blueberries to dig a very shallow but wide hole, maybe 2 or 3 feet across. And then take the soil from that hole, about half of it, and mix that with sphagnum peat moss. So 50-50 soil and peat moss. And then backfill with that mix. And that effectively lowers the pH. They do have a very shallow fibrous root system, so you will have to water on a regular basis that first year, and possibly later when we have extreme drought. I would definitely mulch with like wood chips, shredded bark, and every spring I would go out with either sulfur or ammonium sulfate and sprinkle that around the plant because the sulfur keeps the soil acidic. As far as the grapes, they're pretty easy to grow. All they need is a well-drained site. They don't like wet soils, but it doesn't have to be highly fertile. It does need to be in full sun, at least 6 hours of direct sun, and make sure that you keep it watered the first year.
All right. And let's go to the phones now. Rick is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have my daughter is getting a big, wonderful playset for her birthday at the end of May, and I have a lilac bush that I'm going to need to try to move. And I know that the fall is the best time, and I was just wondering if there's any suggestions on if it's even going to be possible.
How big is it?
Oh, it's pretty well established, Richard. I'd say it's at least 10 or 15 years old. I cut it back every year to about 8 feet.
Okay.
To keep it small. But it's well established.
So what I'd probably do is go out there, if you want to do it this year, do it within the next week or 10 days if you can while it's still dormant.
Okay.
And so well,
I do have some buds coming.
Okay.
I mean, the original flower buds, I guess.
Right. But they haven't started to leaf out yet. So they're still dormant. They should remain dormant for another, I would guess, maybe 2 weeks, possibly 3 weeks.
Okay.
And so I would go out there and probably cut out the largest, tallest stems near the ground, get rid of some of that older growth.
Right.
And then, when it's smaller in size, maybe try to kind of tie the shrub together a little bit with some twine.
Okay.
So it's not as wide, so you can kind of work around it more easily.
Uh-huh.
And then I would dig it up with a nice ball of dirt and replant immediately.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Rick. And next up, let's go to Harvey on the line in Mason City. Hi, Harvey.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, from time to time, my house plants over the winter, one of them will get infested with aphids. That seems to happen a lot. Should I just throw the plant away, which I don't like to do? Is there some way I can get rid of the aphids?
Yeah, aphids can be a headache, especially on the house plants, and I'm always amazed at where they show up and where they've been. But once they get going, they really get going. And usually the soap-based insecticides are very effective at controlling soft-bodied insects like aphids. What it really just takes is a little bit of persistence. It's usually hard to get good coverage the first time. You miss a few aphid females. They just clone themselves and produce daughters live, so they're able to reproduce very fast. So usually we recommend using that insecticide, focusing underneath the leaves where the aphids are because it only kills on contact. And before you do this, you can even, if you're able, rinse off the plant in the shower or something to get off as many aphids, and then just watch again in another week at least and probably treat again.
Okay. You think I've dunked them in warm water, upside down, in soapy warm water. It didn't seem to help. Maybe that's not as good a way as what you're recommending.
Right. And I think maybe with the dunking, you end up with air bubbles or some things like that. It may not have gotten around the aphids like we would like well enough. And, you know, if the leaves got stuck together, it would protect the aphids. So I almost think, you know, maybe a good rinse in the shower and then go ahead back through with the, you know, in a spray bottle and get the soapy water underneath.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, Harvey, thanks a lot for your call. And we've got a couple of lines open for your questions at 866-780-9100. Or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is an email from Joel. We have persistent and very discouraging problems with stem borers in potatoes and vine borers in squash and cucumbers. What kind of organic controls can we try?
Squash vine borer. I never get any squash from my garden, so maybe I'm not the best one to give advice on this. But that female wasp or moth comes in, she lays her eggs, and then the caterpillar burrows in, and then there's very little you can do about it once it's burrowed in. There are like pheromone traps, like we were talking about earlier, available where you can time when the moths are flying and when you should, you know, have a treatment on. I mean, things like the Dipel organic BT would work. It's getting them on at the right time. Now, once it's in there, you can, I mean, then we're talking if you just have a few plants, you can go in and kill the caterpillar in the stem and sometimes either just slit the stem, kill the caterpillar, rebury the stem, and that will sometimes work. But those are very frustrating garden pests. Now, the stalk borer, that tends to move from grass into the garden. So it starts out earlier in the year. It's feeding inside grass. And then as the caterpillar gets too large for grass, it will move into the garden into things like tomatoes and others. So keeping grass short and mowed around the garden is one way to reduce problems with the stalk borer.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Les is on the line in New Hartford. Hi, Les.
Hi. I have real sandy soil for my yard and my grass, and I tend to get sand burrs, you know, those plants.
I hate sand burrs. Ugh.
Yeah. What's the best way to get rid of them and then to keep them out?
Again, I think the best way is to try to achieve that very dense stand of grass so that the seeds cannot germinate and survive in that environment. So I think that's the best way of dealing with it. So I guess if you're going with bluegrass, then I would choose some of the low-maintenance varieties, and there are a number of those that probably would deal with dry conditions better than some of the high-maintenance varieties that require irrigation. So I would go with some of the low-maintenance bluegrass varieties. You could probably try tall fescue also. That would be a possibility, too. Tall fescue is more drought tolerant than Kentucky bluegrass. I mean, another possibility, but I would try to achieve that really dense, thick turf so that the sand burrs don't have much of an opportunity.
Should I have the grass higher because it's sandier?
Well, I would be mowing probably around 2.5 to 3 inches in the spring and fall. And so if you're doing that, mow the grass when it's about 4 inches tall. And then in the summer, I'd be mowing around 3, 3.5 inches for us as far as height. So a little bit higher is fine. Definitely don't go out there and mow the grass at a 2-inch height and let it get to be maybe 5 or 6 inches because that's cutting off too much at once, and that definitely does stress the grass. It may take the grass a few days or weeks to recover, and that provides an opportunity for the sand burrs.
And getting rid of the ones that are there is pulling about the only way to do it?
They are an annual plant, so once they come up, the best way to do it is to dig them up or pull them out, yes.
All right. Good luck, Les. Thanks a lot for your call. And Kim from Ida County has this question. Can I plant pumpkin seeds directly in the garden, or do I need to transplant them?
Actually, many people plant them directly in the garden. And so probably sometime around mid-May. Now, if you want to, you can start them inside. If you do that, I would start them inside about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before you intend to plant them outside. And I would plant those in peat pots because they don't transplant very well in plastic pots.
All right. Back to the phones at 866-780-9100. Marshall is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
I planted several, like 18, emerald green arborvita in my backyard last year in the spring, and all but two died despite frequent watering throughout the summer. And I'm wondering, my goal is to create a privacy, natural mm-hmm. privacy fence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if I should stick the money into it and try to plant them again. If so, when? Wait a year or what? or go with some other variety?
Yeah, unfortunately, you had the worst possible year last year. That's unfortunate.
I thought so.
So if you like arborvitae, I might go to a different variety.
Okay.
I like Techne, which is a fairly common variety. Tends to be very reliable for the most part.
Okay.
It grows about 10 to 12 feet tall and
right.
gets to be around 8 to 10 feet wide. A nice green color. It doesn't discolor during the winter like some varieties do. So I'd be inclined to maybe go with Techne over Emerald.
Okay. A couple of my neighbors have Technes. My concern is my yard isn't enormous, and I don't want it filled up with trees.
Okay.
But, you know, if those are my two options, when do you recommend planting?
Well, I guess I would try again. You just can't predict the weather. I wish I could. If I was going to plant this year, it would be basically in late April, early May.
Okay.
And give them good care all spring and summer into winter. In fact,
okay.
I would be watering until the ground froze in November or December.
Yep, that was my plan last year.
Yeah, so, and I think the climatologist is indicating it's going to be not quite as warm this year and not quite as dry. So it's going to be a little bit better as far as growing conditions, hopefully.
That would be good news
that
for everybody.
That would be very good.
All right, good luck.
One last follow-up question.
Okay.
I did not put wood chips on them when I planted them. Do you recommend chipping around them?
Well, the wood chips would serve as a mulch, and that would help to conserve moisture. And that's always beneficial when you have a dry year because bare ground dries out very quickly. A mulched surface does not, so it's very helpful.
All right, Marshall, thanks for your call. And on the subject of arborvitae, Grant sent this email from Marion. I have a line of 12-year-old emerald green arborvitae which were damaged by ice and snow. Portions of the plants are now bent over and in some cases broken at the base. What should I do to preserve these plants now?
Yeah, we had a very heavy snow, I think, in early, just before Christmas in December. And arborvitaes tend to be multi-stemmed. And they're not real, real rigid as far as those stems. And so some kind of broke and some kind of fell over. If they're partially broken, you're going to have to cut them off because they're not going to heal. And so you might as well just get rid of that broken portion. The other ones you may have to kind of tie up and support for a while. And so you can use a stake. Use something that goes around them that would not cut them. You could use old nylon stocking, for example, or maybe some rubber bands or something of that nature.
All right, and let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. This is Julie from Waverly. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question, quickly?
So, real quick, so I'm trying to plant a, privacy hedgerow, but my challenge is that it's pretty much in deep shade. I'm looking for a recommendation of something to plant there. We tried some arborvitaes, you know, and same thing. A lot of them died last year.
Okay, and how tall do they have to be?
Well, you know, probably about 6-7 foot.
Okay. I think an upright yew might be your best choice on that. Yews are evergreen. We can definitely grow them. They're pretty easy to grow, so I would look for some of the upright cultivars, not the spreading type, but more the upright type, and those would be a possibility.
All right. Good luck with that, Julie. And a final question from Bruce. When do I prune back last year's growth on tall ornamental grasses?
This weekend, if you can.
All right. I was anticipating that answer. Richard, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and Laura Jesse, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Laura Jesse of the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.